Okay, I want to pick up where we left off in 1 Chronicles. We left off in this chapter 8, and for anybody that's new here, like Phyllis, you came at the wrong night, man. Oh, I could say it's
well, I was here when you started.
Oh, you were? Okay, well, we're still going through this. We're still plowing through this. I mean, I'm
thinking you're only on 8.
Yeah. Well, I'm telling.
I was reading it. I got up to 12.
Yeah, this is so bad in terms of trying to get through this, but I'm determined that we're not going to skip any of God's word. We're going to get through it. The problem is, you know, the first 9 chapters, and it actually encompasses the first 12 chapters of 1 Chronicles, it really gets difficult because there's over 500 names of people and places, and I'm sure you're all agonizing in this painful exercise as I'm mutilating and lacerating this slow motion train wreck of just me trying to pronounce these names. But you know what? I'm just determined. We just got to go through it. And I'll be glad when we get out of this. But I do feel like it's important that we look at God's word from the perspective where Jesus said, man doesn't live on bread alone, but every word that proceeds from the mouth of God. So even though I'm butchering a lot of these people's names, and there's not a whole lot of meat there, we're still going to go through it. Anyway, beginning with this chapter 8. Of 1 Chronicles, we're going to be dealing with the tribe of Benjamin here. And anybody remember what Benjamin means before we even get started? Just keep this in mind.
Sorrow or some pain?
Well, no, that's Benoni. In other words, when Rachel,
yeah.
She was giving birth to Benjamin, she was dying. And as her soul was beginning to depart, she said to her husband Jacob, name him Benoni, which means son of my sorrow. And Jacob said, no, I'm not going to name him that. I'm going to name him Benjamin, which means son of my right hand. An interesting thing, too. This is just a side note, one of these trivia things that doesn't amount to anything. But Jacob called him son of my right hand. But there was thousands, thousands, thousands of Benjaminites that were noted for being left-handed. They were extremely skilled in the slingshot and in war, and the majority of them appears to were left-handed, but Jacob called them son of my right hand. So there's your trivia for today. Anyway, at verse 1 of chapter 8 of 1 Chronicles, it says, and Benjamin became the father of Bela, his firstborn, Ashbel the second, Uriah the third, Noah the fourth, and Rephah the fifth. Bela had sons, Adar, Gear, Abihud, Abishua, Naaman, Ohiah, Gera, Shephuniah, and Huram. These were the sons of Ehud. Now, before we go any further here, this is kind of significant to me because it's naming the sons of Benjamin. But then if you look at if you go back to Genesis chapter 46, it lists his sons there. And there's a tremendous discrepancy here in this particular genealogy when he lists the sons of Benjamin compared to Genesis chapter 46. Because if you go to Genesis chapter 46, it talks about the sons of Benjamin that were Bela, Becher, Ashbel, Gera, Naaman, Ehi, Rosh, Huppin, and Ard. And then over here, they're not even listing them all, but they start with Bela. And then they go to Ashbel and Ahikah or Heira and Noah and Raphah. Now, these names aren't even close, and they're not even the full descendants from Benjamin. In other words, there's only listed here 5, and there was actually 9 sons of Benjamin. Now, my point is just simply this. You wonder, well, what was the person who was putting this all together? What was he thinking? And here's a couple of things, because I know that I deal with critics of the Bible all the time, and they're just going to camp here, and they're just going to say, well, here's all these contradictions. These names aren't even close. But keep a couple things in mind. Who did I say it most likely was the one that wrote this book of 1 Chronicles and 2nd?
Ezra.
Now, here's the thing. Ezra was actually born in Babylon. All right. He was born in captivity. He was born in exile. He was born of the tribe of Levi, and he became a scribe, and he was a priest. And he was one of the first ones to come back from the deportation. He was one of the first waves to go back to Jerusalem. It was under Cyrus in 539 B.C. when Cyrus gave the permission for the Jews to leave. He was the one that basically organized one of the first waves to go back to Jerusalem. And he did an awful lot of work when it came to, you know, compiling these genealogies. But now here's the thing that I think for me is a logical explanation as to why these names, some of them don't even jive, is, do you remember when we went through the book of Daniel? It's been a long, long time ago. But we read in the first chapter where it was Daniel, and he had three companions. He had a companion by the name of Hananiah and Mishael and Azariah. Now, these were their Hebrew names. And what's interesting to me is, anybody remember what Daniel means?
Judge?
Yeah, good. God judges, or God is my judge. And Hananiah means Jehovah favored, or Jehovah has favored, or the Lord has favored. And Mishael means who is what God is. In other words, it basically means who is comparable to God. And Azariah means whom Jehovah helps, or whom the Lord helps. But now, interesting thing. When these Hebrews got over there to Babylon as young men, their names were changed.
Right.
Remember, it was the overseer who changed their names because he did not like their names, because they had Hebrew names and it was all, you know, names that were pointing to the God of heaven. So what Ararat, who was the overseer of these young boys who were going through this schooling, he changed their names. He changed Daniel's name to Belteshazzar. Belteshazzar, it means Baal's prince. All right? And also he changed Hananiah's name, which means Jehovah has favored. He changed it to Shadrach, which means inspired by the sun god. And then Mishael, which means who is comparable to God, he changed his name to Meshach, and it means who is comparable to Shach, which is one of their gods and a whole pantheon of gods, right? And Azariah, it means whom the Lord helps, or whom the Jehovah helps. His name was changed to Abednego, which means the servant of the shining fire, or the fire god. Look at these guys' names. Let's just say you didn't know about that chapter 1 of Daniel, but you knew about Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. But then somewhere down the line, you start reading Belshazzar, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And you'd say, well, here's a contradiction here. This wasn't their names, right? And my point is just simply this. He's coming out of Babylon, Ezra, and I believe that that's why these names, sometimes they can be so distorted or so convoluted that you say, well, this doesn't match this other genealogy over here. So some of these names, even though they don't match up into previous genealogies, I think that the explanation is that they were changed, or they were modified, or they were basically distorted in Babylon. So, you know, that's probably neither here nor there, but it does explain to me why there's discrepancy here. But then it says in this verse 6 of 1 Chronicles chapter 8, it says, these are the sons of Ehud. These are the heads of the father's households of the inhabitants of Geba, and they carried them into exile in Manahath, namely Naaman, Ahijah, and Gera. He carried them into exile, and he became the father of Uzzah and Ahihud. Now, before we go any further here, he's mentioning these other descendants. Now, these, apparently, they're not even direct descendants of Benjamin. When I say direct, they do go all the way back to Benjamin, but these are sub-clans. And I have no idea why, you know, Ezra is only including certain people. I can only assume that perhaps one of his reasons is that he doesn't have the full genealogy of every single, you know, Benjamite, because it was supposed to have been kept in the temple, right? Well, the temple was destroyed. So I think that he's probably piecing things together, and I think that in his mind's eye, it was important that even though he was naming these different subclans, as far as Benjamin is concerned, I think his primary, let's say, goal was to show how the Benjaminites led all the way down to the first king of Israel, which was who?
Saul.
Saul was a Benjamite, all right? And I think that that's one of his reasons. But also it says that these people were led off into captivity, led off into exile. And, you know, we went through 1 Kings, we went through 2 Kings, we went through Samuel, we went through Jeremiah, we went through Ezekiel, and we read all about these people who went into exile. And, you know, God said he was going to bring them into exile because of all their wickedness and because of all their idolatry and because of all their bloodshed and all of their crimes. You know, that's why God judged them. So when it talks about here, these are the ones that were led off into exile, I think it says a lot. And I don't want to get off on a tangent here, but God judged these people not only because of all of their wickedness and their idolatry and they were led off into exile, but also there were so many people who were totally indifferent to the moral decay that was happening all around them. And that really, really gave a foothold for evil to take over. And I would say this, we're going to go into exile ourselves. And I don't get me wrong here. I'm just speaking kind of figuratively or metaphorically here. What I mean is we are going to go under judgment as a nation. And one of the main reasons is because of where we are at morally, spiritually. It's like there's that old adage that says the only thing needed for evil to triumph is what? For good men to do nothing. And I think it's kind of significant because last weekend I actually went down to San Francisco because they had this huge pro-life rally down there. And I mean, there was tens of thousands of people down there. I'm not kidding. I would say between 50 and 100,000 people, right, at this rally. But then when the march finally got on the way, and it was about a mile and a half march, or a mile, I forget how long it was, but then you had, you know, people on the side when you're going down there, and they all had kinds of different signs that were vilifying the people who were pro-life. And they were saying things like, well, you know how one of the pro-life slogans is life begins at conception. Well, one of the signs says, well, life begins when we do away with Christian fanaticism or Christian fanatics and this type of thing that was just going on there. And one thing that people have to understand, because this last Tuesday I taught a Bible study in the morning, and they were talking about this. And one of the guys had said to me, this was even before the Bible study started, he said, you know, I get tired of this kind of stuff. They shouldn't even mention this whole pro-life, pro-choice type of thing. You know, it's just irrelevant. We shouldn't even deal with it. And I said, no, that's not the right attitude to have. And I said, the reason being is this, is that this kind of indifference is really going to bring the wrath of God, because I really think it's what Ezekiel wrote in chapter 34 when God was pronouncing a judgment upon Teman and upon Edom. This is what God said in regards to these the Edomites, who happened to be, you know, blood brothers of the Israelites. But God said this in chapter 35. He says, because you have everlasting enmity and did have delivered the sons of Israel to the power of the sword at the time of their calamity, at the time of the punishment of the end. Now listen to this. Therefore, as I live, declares the Lord, I will give you over to bloodshed, and bloodshed will pursue you, since you have not hated bloodshed. Therefore, bloodshed will pursue you. Now I'm going to read that again. This is what God said through his prophet Ezekiel in regards to Edomites. He said this, as I live, declares the Lord, I will give you over to bloodshed, and bloodshed will pursue you, since you have not hated bloodshed. Therefore, bloodshed will pursue you. And I know that people just despise me for bringing this unpleasant reality up, but I'm telling you this, all right? The reason why bloodshed is pursuing us today, people are pulling their hair out every time there's a mass killing, especially when little kids are involved, and people are blaming the guns. But I'm saying, no. This is all coming back to us full circle. And God said, like in Deuteronomy chapter 28, when he listed curse after curse after curse after curse after curse after curse that would come upon his people if they began to forsake him and act with hostility towards him and start disobeying him. But the interesting word that God used, he said, all these curses will overtake you. I'm going to repeat that. God said this, if you start acting with more and more hostility towards me, all right, and getting involved in all these things that I forbid you to get involved with, then all these curses will overtake you. That suggests to me, you know what, it comes from behind. We don't have eyes in the back of our head. We can't see it coming. I'm looking at what was happening there, and they have these people over there, and there didn't seem to be that many of them who were basically vilifying the people that were marching. But like I said, there could have been as many as 100,000 people there marching for life, and all I could see off the sides was maybe a few dozen. All right, but this is the way that the media portrayed it. This was the way the media portrayed it. First of all, I looked in the Sacramento Bee; it wasn't there.
Nothing.
It wasn't there. But here, they've got. It's almost like you see the pro-lifers and the pro-choicers. But look at the picture. It's like the picture itself is exactly the same size, and they don't show the crowds. They just showed one person with a sign and one person with another sign, right? And then they said that these people who were pro-choice, they said there was 1,000 of them. And then they didn't give you the number of the people who were walking for life.
That is awful.
Well, all I'm saying is this. You see what's happening in our society today?
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's why when we're reading about these people that went into exile, the survivors, you got to ask, well, you know, why did they go into exile? Well, for all of their hostility and disobedience to God, but one of the major things is God says this, because you did not hate bloodshed, bloodshed will pursue you. See, there's too many people in the church today, way too many, who feel like, well, you know what, that abortion, don't even bring that subject up. We got other things we got to deal with. And I'm thinking, you know, that's ground zero. And that just shows that we do not hate this evil. We do not hate it. And then that's why this bloodshed is pursuing us. It's overtaking us, but nobody's got the good grace to see it. You see what I'm saying? Yeah.
And what really works me, I mean, God says the little ones, suffer not the little ones, you know, have a millstone tied around your neck, thrown in the ocean, and make one of these little ones stumble. I mean, I don't get it how anybody in the church who's a Christian can't see how much God values the helpless children and say that, oh, it's not a big deal, not an issue, you know.
Well,
I mean, it's just amazing that can possibly...
Yeah, and I want to say this too clearly because, you know, there was a number of women down there who were giving their testimony who have had abortions, right? And they really have had their hearts touched and they've changed. And women that go through that, they go through a lot in terms of the mental and emotional, spiritual anguish. Some of them don't care, but the ones that, really regretted doing that. Okay, so I understand it, and God certainly understands that people in their fallen state can make some poor decisions on top of poor decisions. And I would just simply say this clearly. Anyone who's ever had an abortion, it's not an unforgivable sin. But we have to come to terms with this sin. And we have to ask God to forgive us. And all these women that were up there giving their testimony, they've all come to grips with it. And they've all have now given their life to Jesus Christ. And now they have a peace over it. They really do. And so what I'm saying is this. People, they can change. But the majority of people in this country, they're indifferent to this horrendous crime. And now this is overtaking us. This bloodshed is pursuing us. I'll bet you $10. Pick up the paper tomorrow. There'll be a mass killing. And just keep that in mind. God says, because you didn't hate bloodshed, bloodshed will pursue you. You see, nobody sees that, though. And so because we don't hate evil, or because Israel didn't hate evil, bloodshed pursued them, and they went into exile, right? But now he says this in this, we'll pick up on that verse 6 again, because it says, these are the sons of Ehud. These are the heads of the father's household of the inhabitants of Geba. They carried them into exile in Mahanaim. Now, Mahanaim, you can't find it. Oh, excuse me. What is that? Mahanaim. Yeah, Mahanaim. I just believe that it was probably a city or a town, a village over there in Babylon that they named that because that's where it said they were carried. All right. I can't find that on the map. But anyway, verse 7, it says, namely, Naaman, Ahijah, and Gera. He carried them into exile, and he became the father of Uzzah and Ahihud. Shaharim became the father of children in the country of Moab after he had sent away Husham and Bera, his wives. By Hodisha, his wife, he became the father of Jobab, Zibiah, and Misha, and Malkim. Jeus, Shekiah, and Mima, these were his sons, heads of the father's household. By Husham, he became the father of Ahitub and Elpal. Now, before we go any farther, it's talking about this guy Shaharaim became the father of children in the country of Moab after he had sent away Husham and Bara, his wives. Mm-hmm. Now, what does that suggest to you? What does it mean, send them away?
That says divorce.
Yeah, yeah. Now, interesting thing. I don't want to get in a whole new thing about this divorce here. But here's a guy. You go back to the Old Testament. Matter of fact, you go back to the New Testament where people came up to Jesus and said, hey, Moses issued a decree of divorce, which he did in Deuteronomy. All right. And he said, what do you say about divorce? And Jesus Christ said this. Moses only gave that decree to issue a certificate of divorce because of the hardness of your heart. He says it wasn't so like in the beginning. In the beginning, he said, God created a male and female and the two shall become one flesh. Right. So Jesus really spoke out against divorce. And here's another hot button issue item. That I just want to say this. There's so many people in the church today, and the people in my own family, they've been divorced. Divorce is not an unforgivable sin, but we have to get back to God's blueprint, all right, and say, okay, what does God feel about this situation? And in Malachi, it says that God hates divorce. But you tell me, why does God hate divorce so much? What is the primary reason?
Isn't it because it's symbolic
of Christ and church?
Yeah.
Yes, but then take it further than that. Where we are told in Corinthians of chapter 6, where Paul says that, hey man, don't you realize that the one who joins himself to a prostitute becomes one body with her, but the one who joins himself to the Lord becomes one spirit with God? Because he quoted from Genesis where it says, and the two shall become one flesh, and Jesus Christ quoted that himself. It's one of the most profound things I've ever read in Scripture. One of the most profound things, if not the most profound thing, where in Corinthians, God is clearly saying that, hey, matter of fact, let me just read it, because in 1 Corinthians chapter 6, it says this, do you not know that your bodies are the members of Christ? Shall I then take away the members of Christ and make them members of a prostitute? May it never be. Or do you not know that the one who joins himself to a prostitute is one with her? For he says, or God said, the two shall become one flesh, but the one who joins himself to the Lord becomes one spirit with them. So it is a reflection of this one spirit union between God and the individual soul, or between Christ and his church, or Christ and his bride, right? But then you take it a little even further than that in terms of what divorce does to children.
Right.
That is so devastating, all right, to kids. It just is. And we're just seeing the end results of what's happening here when you've got so many kids today that are growing up without a father. You know, my wife's in education. Other people who come to this Bible study are in education, and they can tell you one of the biggest problems is unruly kids, undisciplined kids. And almost every time you've got a problem child, he's growing up in a dysfunctional family where there is no father. You go down to the prisons there, 80-90% of these guys grew up without a father. And now we just have this whole mindset, especially in inner cities, where guys are just fathering kids here, there, and everywhere, and they're not taking responsibility for them. But who's taking responsibility for them?
Taxpayers.
Yes, the government. The government is coming out and say, well, you fathers, you want to father kids here, there, and everywhere. That's fine. Just do what you're saying. We'll take care of your kids. We'll be a father to your kids. We'll raise your kids. But look at what's happening. These kids are growing up, and they are completely, completely lost. All right? There was actually the situation that happened over there in Africa where, you know, the game wardens over there, they wanted to populate this one area of Africa with a bunch of elephants. And so they took all these young male elephants. They took them away from their bull elephant fathers. They took them away and they transported them over to this other portion of Africa where they wanted to populate that place with elephants. But what they found out was that these park rangers were finding more and more dead rhinos all over the place. And they couldn't figure out what's happening to these rhinos. And then they were able to discover that all these young elephants that were taken away from their fathers and put in a different portion of the parks over there, these elephants began to become roving gangs. And they began to attack the rhinos and kill the rhinos. You see, because what happens to these elephants is when they have a bull elephant there, the bull elephant teaches them, keeps them in line. And then, see, look at this on a human level. What happens when guys grow up without a father? Very often they will get involved with gangs, won't they? And they will become violent. They will become criminal. It just go down the line here. Now, I know that I'm kind of over the map here, but I'm talking about being exiled. I'm talking about this particular man, you know, who sent his wife away. And they were talking about his descendants here and how it can have a detrimental effect upon the next generation or generation after that and generation after that. I think it does say a lot. And now we're just going to wind this down pretty quick because it says in this verse 12, the sons of Elpal were Eber, Mishaim, and Shemed, who built Ono and Lod with its towns. And Berea and Shema, who were heads of his father's household, of the inhabitants of Ajalon, who put to flight the inhabitants of Gath. Just to throw this out here, anybody remember that where the first mention of Ajalon was in the Bible? When we went through the book of Joshua, Ajalon was a city there, and I think it's kind of significant because that was when, you know, God performed just a major, major miracle, because this is what Joshua said when he was dealing with these five kings over there when they were entered the promised land and they were at war with all of these people of Cana. Mm-hmm. It says this, then Joshua spoke to the Lord in a day when the Lord delivered the Amorites before the sons of Israel, and he said in the sight of Israel, O sun, stand still at Gibeon, and O moon in the valley of Ajalon. So the sun stood still and the moon stopped until the nation avenged themselves on their enemies. Is it not written in the book of Jashar? And the sun stopped in the middle of the sky and did not hasten to go down for about a whole day. There was no day like that day before it or after it when the Lord listened to the voice of a man, for the Lord fought for Israel. Then Joshua and all Israel returned to the camp. My point is this. That was the place where God did a tremendous miracle. In other words, he stopped the whole movement of the universe. All right, if you're going to say, well, I don't think that he did that. Well, all I'm saying is this. We calculate our watches and our calendars by the movement of the stars, and it says that God just stopped everything. All right, and the sun didn't go down for about a whole day. Everything would have to stop, and nobody felt a thing. I mean, you talk about a powerful miracle. I mean, this earth is spinning on its axis at 1,000 miles an hour. It's hurling around the sun at 67,000 miles an hour. Our solar system is moving like over a million miles an hour. Our galaxy is. And then now our universe, they say that it's expanding at a speed that's exceeding the speed of light. That's the kind of velocity that we're moving at right now. And God reversed it all, stopped it all, reversed it all. And I just throw that out here because I looked at that word Ajalon, and it says a lot as far as their history goes. And then it says here in verse 14, it says this, and Ahio, Shashak, and Jerimoth, Zebediah, Arad, Eder, Michael, Ishpa, and Joha were the sons of Berea, or Berea, however you pronounce that, then Zebediah, and Meshulam, and Hiskai, and Eber, Ishmeraiah, Ishliah, and Jobab were the sons of El-Padal, Jakim, Zichri, and Zabdi, Elnei, Zil-Ethai, and Eli-El, and Adiah, and Beraiah, and Shimrath were the sons of Shimei, Ishpan, Eber, Eliel, Abdon, Zichri, Haan, Haaniah, Elaim, and Thothijah, Ifdiah, and Penuel were the sons of Shashak, and Shamchirai, Shehaiah, at Haaliah, Jerishia, Elijah, and Zichri were the sons of Jeroham. Now, that's Zichri. I mean, we've mentioned him three times going through this. That's what I'm saying, man. People name their kids, and then they name their grandkids, and then they name their kids' kids. You know, even the same name. But all I'm saying is, man, sometimes I feel like I'd like to slap these parents for naming their kids. You know, just to make a fool out of me. But anyway, and then he goes on to that, verse 28. These are the heads of their father's households according to their generations, chief men who lived in Jerusalem. Now in Gibeon, Jael, the father of Gibeon, lived, and his wife's name was Makah. And his firstborn son was Abdon, and then Zur, and Kish, Baal, Nadab, Gedor, Ahio, Zikr, Milkloth, became the father of Shimei, and they also lived with their relatives in Jerusalem opposite their relatives. Now, we're just going to wind this down because it's now going to give basically the genealogy of Saul. And like I said, Saul was the very first king of Israel. But When we're reading about his descendants, or basically what happened to him, it's a pretty tragic thing, because Saul, in my opinion, he had such potential for greatness. I really believe that he really did. And I think he was a man who in many respects was a good king, because he was always out there on the front line fighting for his people. But what brought that guy down was his disobedience. And because he did not fully obey the Lord judged him. And the Lord said, I'm going to, you know, take away your kingdom, right? Mm-hmm. And here's the thing, that when Saul only did partial obedience when it came to fulfilling God's command, when it came to judging the Amalekites and wiping them out because of all their wickedness, God said, I want you to wipe out this whole tribe of people, the Amalekites, and every man, woman, and child, and all of their spoils, you are to wipe them out. Every cat, every dog, every sheep, every ox, every donkey, every camel, you wipe them all out. Well, what Saul did is he only had partial obedience, and he kept back some of the things he wasn't supposed to. But now, you tell me, because the critic of the Bible is going to come along and say, what kind of God is this that would demand women and children and all this stuff to be killed, including the animals? But why did God say, you wipe it all out, including all their spoils, wipe it all out? God wanted to make it abundantly clear to everybody, okay, the Canaanites as well as the Israelites, that these people are being destroyed for their wickedness and what they did to you when you first came out of Egypt. And nobody to misinterpret this. If you take one single stinking dime, but it belongs to them, people are going to say, you only did this, you only attacked them for their spoils. And God wanted to be abundantly clear that this was his judgment. But when Samuel rebuked Saul, he said to Saul, when Saul says, well, you know, I did obey the Lord. And Samuel said to Saul, what's this bleating of the sheep that I hear? So Saul says, well, the men wanted to keep some of the stuff. And then what was his rationalization?
To give it to the Lord.
Because if we keep some of it, we can offer some of it to the Lord. See, we can always justify, we can always rationalize, we can always excuse, right? Because why? Our heart's deceitful above all things, desperately sick. In other words, throw a sin out there. I don't care what sin it is, our hearts are so deceitful we can justify it. Yeah. We can rationalize it. We can plead the purity of anything, and Saul did exactly that. Well, we're going to give some of it to the Lord, right? Well, what did Samuel say? He said, hey, stubbornness is as a sin of idolatry, and rebellion is as a sin of witchcraft.
Yeah.
Now, what that says a lot to me is this. When people really get into becoming more and more stubborn and more rebellious, they open themselves up to demonic influence, and then if it goes bad enough or far enough, it could even become demonic possession. So when we're dealing with Saul here, he had so much potential, but because of his constant, continuous disobedience and his rebellion, finally, the night before he died in battle, he calls forth a witch, the witch of Endor, to call up Samuel.
Spirit.
This is how far gone he had fallen, you see? So I'm going to wind this down now. We just read these names. It says in this verse 33 of 1 Chronicles chapter 8, it says, Ner became the father of Kish, Kish became the father of Saul, Saul became the father of Jonathan, Malchishua, Bimbadad, and Ishbal. Now, these are the Saul's sons. They died with him in battle. Mm-hmm. And it says the son of Jonathan was Meribaal. Now, that Meribaal is the same as Mephibosheth. All right? Like I'm saying, some of these spellings are different. Mm-hmm. But Mephibosheth, remember, he was the one who was, his nurse dropped him when he was just a babe. And he broke his legs or crippled him. He was crippled for life. But David, because he wanted to do something to honor his friend Jonathan, you know, he allowed Mephibosheth to eat at his table. All right? So it says that the son of Jonathan was Meribaal. And Meribaal became the father of Micah. And the sons of Micah were Pithon and Melech, Tyria, and Ahaz. Ahaz became the father of Jehoiada, and Jehoiada became the father of Alemeth, Azmeth, Zimri, and Zimri became the father of Mosa. Mosa became the father of Benia. Rapha was his son, and Elisha his son, Azel his son. Azel had six sons, and these were their names. Azrizah, Cam, Boaz, Chiyu, Ishmael, She, Ariah, Obadiah, and Hanan, and all these were the sons of Azel. The sons of Eshek, his brother, were Ulam, his firstborn, Jashus the second, and Eliphelet the third. Verse 4, the sons of Elam were mighty men of valor, archers, had many sons and grandsons, 150 of them. All these were the sons of Benjamin. And like I said, I think that one of the reasons why I think it was Ezra went to great lengths in terms of trying to identify the genealogy of Saul is because he was their first king. But then the kingdom was taken from him because of his continuous constant disobedience before the Lord. Does anybody have anyone to add or share? Mm-hmm.